Chapter 3. Primordial Debts. It begins with two quotes from the Vedic scriptures. Firstly, quote, "In being born, every being is born as debt, owed to the gods, the saints, the fathers, and to men. If one makes a sacrifice, it is because of a debt owing to the gods from birth. If one recites a sacred text, it is because of a debt owing to the saints. If one wishes for offspring, it is because of a debt due to the fathers from birth. And if one gives hospitality, it is a debt owing to men." Unquote. Secondly, "Let us drive away the evil effects of bad dreams, just as we pay off debts." The reason that economics textbooks now begin with imaginary villages is because it's been impossible to talk about real ones. Even some economists have been forced to admit that Smith's land of barter doesn't really exist. The question is, why the myth has been perpetuated anyway? Economists have long since jettisoned other elements of the wealth of nations, for instance, Smith's labor theory of value and disapproval of joint stock corporations. Why not simply write off the myth of barter as a quaint Enlightenment parable, and instead attempt to understand primordial credit arrangements, or anyway, something more in keeping with the historical evidence? The answer seems to be that the myth of barter cannot go away, because it's central to the entire discourse of economics. Recall here what Smith was trying to do when he wrote The Wealth of Nations. Above all, the book was an attempt to establish the newfound discipline of economics as a science. This meant that not only did economics have its own peculiar domain of study, what we now call the economy, though the idea that there even was something called an economy was very new in Smith's day, but that this economy operated according to the laws of much the same sort as Sir Isaac Newton had recently identified as governing the physical world. Newton had represented God as a cosmic watchmaker who had created the physical machinery of the universe in such a way that it would operate for the ultimate benefit of humans, and then let it run on its own. Smith was trying to make a similar Newtonian argument. God, or divine providence, as he put it, had arranged matters in such a way that our pursuit of self-interest would nonetheless, given an unfettered market, be guided, as if by an invisible hand, to promote the general welfare. Smith's famous invisible hand was, as he says in his Theory of Moral Sentiments, the agent of divine providence. It was literally the hand of God. Once economics had been established as a discipline, the theological arguments no longer seem necessary or important. People continue to argue about whether an unfettered free market will really produce the results that Smith said it would, but no one questions whether the market naturally exists. The underlying assumptions that derive from this came to be seen as common sense, so much so that, as I've noted, we simply assume that when two valuable objects do change hands, it will normally be because two individuals have decided they would gain a material advantage by swapping them. One interesting corollary is that, as a result, economists have come to see the very question of the presence or absence of money as not especially important, since money is just a commodity chosen to facilitate exchange, and which we use to measure the value of the other commodities. Otherwise, it has no special qualities. Still, in 1958, Paul Samuelson, one of the leading lights of the neoclassical school that still predominates in modern economic thought, could express disdain for what he called the social contrivance of money. Even in the most advanced industrial economies, he insisted, if we strip exchange down to its barest essentials and peel off the obscuring layer of money, we find that trade between individuals and nations largely boils down to barter. Others spoke of a veil of money obscuring the nature of the real economy, in which people produced real goods and services and swapped them back and forth. Call this the final apotheosis of economics as common sense. Money is unimportant. Economies, real economies, are really vast barter systems. The problem is that history shows that without money, such vast barter systems do not occur. even when economies revert to barter, as Europe was said to do in the Middle Ages, they don't actually abandon the use of money. They just abandon the use of cash. In the Middle Ages, for instance, everyone continued to assess the value of tools and livestock in the old Roman currency, even if the coins themselves had ceased to circulate. It's money that had made it possible for us to imagine ourselves in the way economists encourage us to do, as a collection of individuals and nations whose main business is swapping things. It's also clear that the mere existence of money in itself is not enough to allow us to see the world this way. If it were, the discipline of economics would have been created in ancient Sumer, or anyway, far earlier than 1776, when Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations appeared. The missing element is in fact exactly the thing that Smith was attempting to downplay, the role of government policy. In England, in Smith's day, it became possible to see the market, the world of butchers, ironmongers, and haberdashers, as its own entirely independent sphere of human activity, because the British government was actively engaged in fostering it. This required laws and police, but also specific monetary policies, which liberals like Smith were, successfully, advocating. It required pegging the value of the currency to silver, but at the same time greatly increasing the money supply, and particularly the amount of small change in circulation. This not only required huge amounts of tin and copper, but also careful regulation of the banks that were, at that time, the only source of paper money. The century before The Wealth of Nations had seen at least two attempts to create state-supported central banks, in France and Sweden, that had proved to be spectacular failures. In each case, the would-be central bank issued notes based largely on speculation that collapsed the moment investors lost faith. Smith supported the use of paper money, but like Locke before him, he also believed that the relative success of the Bank of England and the Bank of Scotland had been due to their policy of pegging paper money firmly to precious metals. This became the mainstream economic view, so much so that alternative theories of money as credit, the one that Mitchell Innes advocated, were quickly relegated to the margins, their proponents written off as cranks, and the very sort of thinking that led to bad banks and speculative bubbles in the first place. It might be helpful, then, to consider what these alternative theories actually were. State and credit theories of money. Mitchell Innes was an exponent of what came to be known as the credit theory of money, a position that, over the course of the 19th century, had its most avid proponents not in Mitchell Innes's native Britain, but in two up-and-coming rival powers of the day, the United States and Germany. Credit theorists insisted that money is not a commodity but an accounting tool. In other words, it's not a thing at all. You can no more touch a dollar or a Deutschmark than you can touch an hour or a cubic centimetre. Units of currency are merely abstract units of measurement, and, as the credit theorists correctly noted historically, such abstract systems of accounting emerged long before the use of any particular token of exchange. The obvious next question is, if money is just a yardstick, what then does it measure? The answer was simple. Debt. A coin is, effectively, an IOU. Whereas conventional wisdom holds that a banknote is, or should be, a promise to pay a certain amount of real money, gold, silver, or whatever that might be taken to mean, credit theorists argued that a banknote is simply the promise to pay something of the same value as an ounce of gold. But that's all that money ever is. There's no fundamental difference in this respect between a silver dollar, a Susan B. Anthony dollar coin made of copper-nickel alloy, designed to look vaguely like gold, a green piece of paper with a picture of George Washington on it, or a digital blip on some bank's computer. Conceptually, the idea that a piece of gold is really just an IOU is always rather difficult to wrap one's head around, but something like this must be true, because even when gold and silver coins were in use, they almost never circulated at their bullion value. How could credit money come about? Let's return to the economics professor's imaginary town. Say, for example, that Joshua were to give his shoes to Henry, and rather than Henry owing him a favour, Henry promises him something of equivalent value. Henry gives Joshua an IOU. Joshua could wait for Henry to give him something useful and then redeem it. In that case, Henry would rip up the IOU and the story would be over. But say Joshua were to pass the IOU on to a third party, Sheila, to whom he owes something else. He could tick it off against his debt to a fourth party, Lola. Now Henry will owe that amount to her. Hence is money born. But there's no logical end to it. Say Sheila now wishes to acquire a pair of shoes from Edith, she can just hand Edith the IOU and assure her that Henry is good for it. In principle, there's no reason the IOU could not continue circulating around town for years, provided enough people continue to have faith in Henry. In fact, if it goes on long enough, people might forget about the issuer entirely. Things like this do happen. The anthropologist Keith Hart once told me a story about his brother, who in the 50s was a British soldier stationed in Hong Kong. Soldiers used to pay their bar tabs by writing checks on accounts back in England. Local merchants would often simply endorse them over to each other and pass them around as currency. Once he saw one of his own checks, written 6 months before, on the counter of a local vendor, covered with about 40 different tiny inscriptions in Chinese. What credit theorists like Mitchell Innes were arguing is that if Henry gave Joshua a gold coin instead of a piece of paper, the situation would be essentially the same. A gold coin is a promise to pay something else of equivalent value to the gold coin. After all, a gold coin is not actually useful in itself. One only accepts it because one assumes other people will. In this sense, the value of a unit of currency is not the measure of the value of an object, but the measure of one's trust in other human beings. This element of trust, of course, makes everything more complicated. Early banknotes circulated via a process almost exactly like what I've just described, except that, like the Chinese merchants, each recipient added his or her signature to guarantee the debt's legitimacy. But generally, the difficulty in the charterless position, this is what it came to be called, from the Latin charter, or token, is to establish why people would continue to trust a piece of paper. After all, why couldn't anyone just sign Henry's name on an IOU? True, this sort of debt token system might work within a small village where everyone knew one another, or even among more dispersed community, like 16th century Italian or 20th century Chinese merchants, where everyone at least had ways of keeping track of everybody else. But systems like these cannot create a full-blown currency system, and there's no evidence that they ever have. Providing a sufficient number of IOUs to allow everyone in a medium-sized city to be able to carry out a significant portion of their daily transactions in such a currency would require millions of tokens. To be able to guarantee all of them, Henry would have to be almost unimaginably rich. All this would be much less of a problem, however, if Henry were, say, Henry II, King of England, Duke of Normandy, Lord of Ireland, and Count of Anjou. The real impetus for the charterless position, in fact, came out of what came to be known as the German historical school, whose most famous exponent was the historian G.F. Knapp, whose state theory of money first appeared in 1905. If money is simply a unit of measure, it makes sense that emperors and kings should concern themselves with such matters. Emperors and kings were almost always concerned to establish uniform systems of weights and measures throughout their kingdoms. It's also true, as Knapp observed, that once established, such systems tend to remain remarkably stable over time. During the reign of the actual Henry II, 1154 to 1189, just about everyone in Western Europe was still keeping their accounts, using the monetary system established by Charlemagne some 350 years earlier, that is, using pounds, shillings, and pence, despite the fact that some of these coins had never existed. Charlemagne never actually struck a silver pound. None of Charlemagne's actual shillings and pence remained in circulation, and those coins that did circulate tended to vary enormously in size, weight, purity, and value. According to the charterlists, this doesn't really matter. What matters is that there is a uniform system for measuring credits and debts, and that this system remains stable over time. The case of Charlemagne's currency is particularly dramatic because his actual empire dissolved quite quickly, but the monetary system he created continued to be used for keeping accounts within his former territories for more than 800 years. It was referred to in the 16th century quite explicitly as imaginary money, and deniers and livres were only completely abandoned as units of account around the time of the French Revolution. According to Knapp, whether or not the actual physical money stuff in circulation corresponds to this imaginary money is not particularly important. It makes no real difference whether it's pure silver, debased silver, leather tokens, or dried cod, provided the state is willing to accept it in payment of taxes, because whatever the state was willing to accept for that reason became currency. One of the most important forms of currency in England, in Henry's time, were notched tally sticks used to record debts. Tally sticks were quite explicitly IOUs. Both parties to a transaction would take a hazelwood twig, notch it to indicate the amount owed, and then split it in half. The creditor would keep one half, called the stock, hence the origin of the term stockholder, and the debtor kept the other, called the stub, hence the origin of the term ticket stub. Tax assessors used such twigs to calculate amounts owed by local sheriffs. Often, though, rather than wait for the taxes to come due, Henry's exchequer would often sell the tallies at a discount, and they would circulate as tokens of debt owed to the government to anyone willing to trade for them. Modern banknotes actually work on a similar principle, except in reverse. Recall here the little parable about Henry's IOU. The reader might have noticed one puzzling aspect of the equation. The IOU can operate as money only as long as Henry never pays his debt. In fact, this is precisely the logic on which the Bank of England, the first successful modern bank, was originally founded. In 1694, a consortium of English bankers made a loan of £1.2 million to the king. In return, they received a royal monopoly on the issuance of banknotes. What this meant in practice was they had the right to advance IOUs for a portion of the money the king now owed them to any inhabitant of the kingdom willing to borrow from them, or willing to deposit their own money in the bank, in effect to circulate or monetize the newly created royal debt. This was a great deal for the bankers. They got to charge the king 8% annual interest for the original loan, and simultaneously charge interest on the same money to the clients who borrowed it. But it only worked as long as the original loan remained outstanding. To this day, this loan has never been paid back. It cannot be. If it ever were, the entire monetary system of Great Britain would cease to exist. If nothing else, this approach helps solve one of the obvious mysteries of the fiscal policy of so many early kingdoms. Why did they make subjects pay taxes at all? This is not a question we're used to asking. The answer seems self-evident. Governments demand taxes because they wish to get their hands on people's money. But if Smith was right, and gold and silver became money through the natural workings of the market, completely independently of governments, then wouldn't the obvious thing be to just grab control of the gold and silver mines? Then the king would have all the money he could possibly need. In fact, this is what ancient kings would normally do. If there were gold and silver mines in their territory, they would usually take control of them. So, what exactly was the point of extracting the gold, stamping one's picture on it, causing it to circulate amongst one's subjects, and then demanding that those same subjects gave it back again? This does seem a bit of a puzzle, but if money in markets do not emerge spontaneously, it actually makes perfect sense, because this is the simplest and most efficient way to bring markets into being. Let us take a hypothetical example. Say a king wishes to support a standing army of 50,000 men. Under ancient or medieval conditions, feeding such a force was an enormous problem. Unless they were on the march, one would need to employ almost as many men and animals just to locate, acquire, and transport the necessary provisions. On the other hand, if one simply hands out coins to the soldiers, and then demands that every family in the kingdom was obliged to pay one of those coins back to you, one would, in one blow, turn one's entire national economy into a vast machine for the provisioning of soldiers, since now every family, in order to get their hands on the coins, must find some way to contribute to the general effort to provide soldiers with things they want. Markets are brought into existence as a side effect. This is a bit of a cartoon version, but it's very clear the markets did spring up around ancient armies. One need only take a glance at Cartilia's Arthasastra, or the Sasanian Circle of Sovereignty, or the Chinese Discourses on Salt and Iron, to discover that most ancient rulers spent a great deal of their time thinking about the relation between mines, soldiers, taxes, and food. Most concluded that the creation of markets of this sort was not just convenient for feeding soldiers, but useful in all sorts of ways, since it meant officials no longer had to requisition everything they needed directly from the populace, or figure out a way to produce it on royal estates or royal workshops. In other words, despite the dogged liberal assumption, again coming from Smith's legacy, that the existence of states and markets are somehow opposed, the historical record implies that exactly the opposite is the case. Stateless societies tend also to be without markets. As one might imagine, state theories of money have always been anathema to mainstream economists working in the tradition of Adam Smith. In fact, Chartism has tended to be seen as a populist underside of economic theory, favored mainly by cranks. The curious thing is that mainstream economists often ended up actually working for governments and advising such governments to pursue policies much like those the Chartists described, that is, tax policies designed to create markets where they had not existed before, despite the fact that they were, in theory, committed to Smith's argument that markets develop spontaneously of their own accord. This was particularly true in the colonial world. To return to Madagascar for a moment, I've already mentioned that one of the first things the French General Gallieni, conqueror of Madagascar, did when the conquest of the island was complete in 1901, was to impose a head tax. Not only was this tax quite high, it was also payable in newly issued Malagasy francs. In other words, Gallieni did indeed print money and then demand that everyone in the country give some of that money back to him. Most striking of all, though, was the language he used to describe the tax. It was referred to as the impôt moralisateur, the educational or moralizing tax. In other words, it was designed, to adopt the language of the day, to teach the natives the value of work. Since the educational tax came due shortly after harvest time, the easiest way for farmers to pay it was to sell a portion of their rice crop to the Chinese or Indian merchants, who soon installed themselves in small towns across the country. However, harvest was when the market price of rice was, for obvious reasons, at its lowest. If one sold too much of one's crops, that meant one would not have enough left to feed one's family for the entire year, and thus be forced to buy back one's own rice, on credit, from those same merchants later in the year, when prices were much higher. As a result, farmers quickly fell hopelessly into debt, the merchants doubling as loan sharks. The easiest ways to pay back the debt was either to find some kind of cash crop to sell, to start growing coffee or pineapples, or else to send one's children off to work for wages in the city, or on the plantations that French colonialists were establishing across the island. The whole project might seem no more than a cynical scheme to squeeze cheap labour out of the peasantry, and it was that, but it was also something more. The colonial government was also quite explicit, at least in their internal policy documents, about the need to make sure that peasants had at least some money of their own left over, and to ensure that they became accustomed to the minor luxuries, parasols, lipstick, cookies, available at the Chinese shops. It was crucial that they develop new tastes, habits, and expectations, that they lay the foundations of a consumer demand, that would endure long after the conquerors had left, and keep Madagascar forever tied to France. Most people are not stupid, and most Malagasy understood exactly what their conquerors were trying to do to them. Some were determined to resist. More than 60 years after the invasion, a French anthropologist, Gérard Attabé, was able to observe villages on the east coast of the island whose inhabitants would dutifully show up at the coffee plantations to earn the money for their poll tax, and then, having paid it, studiously ignore the wares for sale at the local shops, and instead turn over any remaining money to lineage elders, who would then use it to buy cattle for sacrifice to their ancestors. Many were quite open in saying that they saw themselves as resisting a trap. Still, such defiance rarely lasts forever. Markets did gradually take shape, even in those parts of the island where none had previously existed. With them came the inevitable network of little shops, and by the time I got there, in 1990, a generation after the poll tax had finally been abolished by a revolutionary government, the logic of the market had become so intuitively accepted that even spirit mediums were reciting passages that might as well have come from Adam Smith. Such examples could be multiplied endlessly. Something like this occurred in just about every part of the world conquered by European arms, where markets were not already in place. Rather than discovering barter, they ended up using the very techniques that mainstream economics rejected to bring something like the market into being. In search of a myth. Anthropologists have been complaining about the myth of barter for almost a century. Occasionally, economists point out with slight exasperation that there's a fairly simple reason why they're still telling the same story, despite all the evidence against it. Anthropologists have never come up with a better one. This is an understandable objection, but there's a simple answer to it. The reason why anthropologists haven't been able to come up with a simple, compelling story for the origins of money is because there's no reason to believe there could be one. Money was no more ever invented than music or mathematics or jewellery. What we call money isn't a thing at all. It's a way of comparing things mathematically as proportions, of saying 1 of x is equivalent to 6 of y. As such, it's probably as old as human thought. The moment we try to get any more specific, we discover that there are any number of different habits and practices that have converged in the stuff we now call money, and that this is precisely the reason why economists, historians, and the rest have found it so difficult to come up with a single definition. Credit theorists have long been hobbled by the lack of an equally compelling narrative. That is not to say that all sides in the currency debates that range between 1850 and 1950 were not in the habit of deploying mythological weaponry. This was true particularly perhaps in the United States. In 1894, the Greenbackers, who pushed for detaching the dollar from gold entirely to allow the government to spend freely on job creation campaigns, invented the idea of the March on Washington, an idea that was to have endless resonance in U.S. history. L. Frank Baum's book, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, which appeared in 1900, is widely recognized to be a parable for the populist campaign of William Jennings Bryan, who twice ran for president on the free silver platform, vowing to replace the gold standard with a bimetallic system that would allow the free creation of silver money alongside gold. As with the Greenbackers, one of the main constituencies for the movement was debtors, particularly Midwestern farm families such as Dorothy's, who had been facing a massive wave of foreclosures during the severe recession of the 1890s. According to the populist reading, the Wicked Witches of the East and West represent the East and West Coast bankers, promoters of and benefactors from the tight money supply. The Scarecrow represented the farmers, who didn't have the brains to avoid the debt trap. The Tin Woodsman was the industrial proletariat, who didn't have the heart to act in solidarity with the farmers. The Cowardly Lion represented the political class, who didn't have the courage to intervene. The Yellow Brick Road, the Silver Slippers, the Emerald City, and Hapless Wizard presumably speak for themselves. Oz is, of course, a standard abbreviation for ounce, As an attempt to create a new myth, Baum's story was remarkably effective. As political propaganda, less so. William Jennings Bryan failed in 3 attempts to win the presidency, the Silver Standard was never adopted, and few nowadays even remember what The Wonderful Wizard of Oz was originally supposed to be about. For state money theorists in particular, this has been a problem. Stories about rulers using taxes to create markets in conquered territories, or to pay for soldiers or other state functions, are not particularly inspiring. German ideas of money as the embodiment of national will did not travel very well. Every time there was a major economic meltdown, however, conventional laissez-faire economics took another hit. The Bryan campaigns were born as a reaction to the panic of 1893. By the time of the Great Depression of the 1930s, the very notion that the market could regulate itself, so long as the government ensured that the money was safely pegged to precious metals, was completely discredited. From roughly 1933 to 1979, every major capitalist government reversed course and adopted some version of Keynesianism. Keynesianism orthodoxy started from the assumption that capitalist markets would not really work unless capitalist governments were willing effectively to play nanny, most famously by engaging in massive deficit pump priming during downturns. While in the 80s, Margaret Thatcher in Britain and Ronald Reagan in the United States made a great show of rejecting all of this, it's unclear how much they really did, and in any case, they were operating in the wake of an even greater blow to previous monetary orthodoxy. Richard Nixon's decision in 1981 to unpeg the dollar from precious metals entirely, eliminating the international gold standard, and introducing the system of floating currency regimes that has dominated the world economy ever since. This meant, in effect, that all national currencies were henceforth, as neoclassical economists like to put it, fiat money, backed only by public trust. Now, John Maynard Keynes himself was much more open to what he liked to call the alternative tradition of credit and state theories than any economist of that stature, and Keynes is still arguably the single most important economic thinker of the 20th century, before or since. At certain points, he immersed himself in it. He spent several years in the 20s studying the Mesopotamian cuneiform banking records to try to ascertain the origins of money, his Babylonian madness, as he would later call it. His conclusion, which he set forth at the very beginning of his Treatise on Money, his most famous work, was more or less the only conclusion that one could come to if one started not from the first principles, but from a careful examination of the historical record, that the lunatic fringe was, essentially, right. Whatever its earliest origins, for the last 4,000 years, money has effectively been a creature of the state. Individuals, he observed, make contracts with one another. They take out debts, and they promise payments. Quote, "The state, therefore, comes in first of all as an authority of law, which enforces the payment of the thing which corresponds to the name or description in the contract. But it comes doubly when, in addition, it claims the right to determine and declare what thing corresponds to the name, and to vary its declaration from time to time, when, that is to say, it claims the right to re-edit the dictionary. This right is claimed by all modern states, and it has been so claimed for some 4,000 years at least. It is when this stage in the evolution of money has been reached that Knapp's Chartalism, the doctrine that money is peculiarly a creation of the state, is fully realized. Today, all civilized money is, beyond the possibility of dispute, chartalist." Unquote. Now, this doesn't mean that the state necessarily creates money. Money is credit. It can be brought into being by private contractual agreements, loans for instance. The state merely enforces the agreement and dictates the legal terms. Hence Keynes's next dramatic assertion that banks create money, and that there is no intrinsic limit to their ability to do so, since, however much they lend, the borrower will have no choice but to put the money back into some bank again, and thus, from the perspective of the banking system as a whole, The total number of debits and credits will always cancel out. The implications were radical, but Keynes himself was not. In the end, he was always careful to frame the problem in a way that could be reintegrated into the mainstream economics of his day. Neither was Keynes much of a myth-maker. Insofar as the alternative tradition has come up with an answer to the myth of barter, it was not from Keynes's own efforts. Keynes ultimately decided that the origins of money were not particularly important, but in the work of some contemporary neo-Keynesians who were not afraid to follow some of his more radical suggestions as far as they would go. The real weak link in state credit theories of money was always the element of taxes. It's one thing to explain why early states demanded taxes in order to create markets. It's another to ask, by what right? Assuming that early rulers were not simply thugs, and that taxes were not simply extortion, and no credit theorist, to my knowledge, took such a cynical view, even of early government, one must ask how they justified this sort of thing. Nowadays, we all think we know the answer to this question. We pay our taxes so that the government can provide us with services. This starts with security services, military protection being often about the only service some early states were really able to provide. By now, of course, the government provides all sorts of things. All of this is said to go back to some sort of original social contract that everyone somehow agreed on, though no one really knows exactly when or by whom, or why we should be bound by the decisions of distant ancestors on this one matter, when we don't feel particularly bound by the decisions of our distant ancestors on anything else. All of this makes sense if you assume that markets come before governments, but the whole argument totters quickly once you realize that they don't. There is an alternative explanation, one created to be in keeping with the state credit theory approach. It's referred to as primordial debt theory, and it's been developed largely in France by a team of researchers, not only economists, but anthropologists, historians, and classicists, originally assembled around the figures of Michel Alietta and André Orléans, and more recently Bruno Thierry, and it's since been taken up by neo-Keynesians in the United States and the United Kingdom as well. It's a position that has emerged quite recently, and at first, largely amidst debates about the nature of the euro. The creation of a common European currency sparked not only all sorts of intellectual debates. Does a common currency necessarily imply the creation of a common European state, or of a common European economy or society? Are these ultimately the same thing? But dramatic political ones as well. The creation of the Eurozone was spearheaded above all by Germany, whose central banks still see their main goal as combating inflation. What's more, tight money policies and the need to balance budgets have been used as the main weapon to chip away welfare state policies in Europe. It's necessarily become the stake of political struggles between bankers and pensioners, creditors and debtors, just as heated as those of 1890s America. The core argument is that any attempt to separate monetary policy from social policy is ultimately wrong. Primordial debt theorists insist that these have always been the same thing. Governments use taxes to create money, and they're able to do so because they've become the guardians of the debt that all citizens have to one another. This debt is the essence of society itself. It exists long before money and markets, and money and markets themselves are simply ways of chopping pieces of it up. At first, the argument goes, this sense of debt was expressed not through the state, but through religion. To make the argument, Alietta and Orléans fixed on certain works of early Sanskrit religious literature, the hymns, prayers, and poetry, called in the Vedas and Brahmanas, priestly commentaries, composed over the centuries that followed, texts that are now considered the foundations of Hindu thought. It's not as odd a choice as it might seem. These texts constitute the earliest known historical reflections on the nature of debt. Actually, even the very earliest Vedic poems, composed sometime between 1500 and 1200 BC, evince a constant concern with debt, which is treated as synonymous with guilt and sin. There are numerous prayers pleading with the gods to liberate the worshipper from the shackles or bonds of debt. Sometimes these seem to refer to debt in the literal sense. Veda 10.34, for instance, has a long description of the sad plight of gamblers who, quote, wander homeless in constant fear, in debt, and seeking money, unquote. Elsewhere it's clearly metaphorical. In these hymns, Yama, the god of death, figures prominently. To be in debt was to have a weight placed on you by death. To be under any sort of unfulfilled obligation, any unkept promise, to gods or to men, was to live in the shadow of death. Often, even in the very early texts, debt seems to stand in for a broader sense of inner suffering, from which one begs the gods, particularly Agni, who represents the sacrificial fire, for release. It was only with the Brahmanas that commentators started trying to weave all this together into a more comprehensive philosophy. The conclusion? That human existence is itself a form of debt. Quote, a man, being born, is a debt. By his own self he is born to death, and only when he sacrifices does he redeem himself from death. Unquote. Sacrifice, and these early commentators were themselves sacrificial priests, is thus called tribute paid to death, or such was the manner of speaking. In reality, as the priests knew better than anyone, sacrifice was directed to all the gods, not just death. Death was just the intermediary. Framing things this way, though, did immediately raise the one problem that always comes up whenever anyone conceives human life through such an idiom. If our lives are a loan, who would actually wish to repay such a debt? To live in debt is to be guilty, incomplete. But completion can only mean annihilation. In this way, the tribute of sacrifice could be seen as a kind of interest payment, with the life of the animal substituting temporarily for what's really owed, which is ourselves, a mere postponement of the inevitable. Different commentators propose different ways out of the dilemma. Some ambitious Brahmins began telling their clients that sacrificial ritual, if done correctly, promised a way to break out of the human condition entirely and achieve eternity, since, in the face of eternity, all debts become meaningless. Another way was to broaden the notion of debt, so that all social responsibilities become debts of one sort or another. Thus, two famous passages in the Brahmanas insist that we are born as a debt not just to the gods to be repaid in sacrifice, but also to the sages who created the Vedic learning to begin with, which we must repay through study, to our ancestors, the fathers, whom we must repay by having children, and finally to men, apparently meaning humanity as a whole, to be repaid by offering hospitality to strangers. Anyone, then, who lives a proper life is constantly paying back existential debts of one sort or another. But at the same time, as the notion of debt slides back into a simple sense of social obligation, it becomes something far less terrifying than the sense that one's very existence is a loan taken out against death, not least because social obligations always cut both ways, especially since, once one has oneself fathered children, one is just as much a debtor as a creditor. What primordial debt theorists have done is to propose that the ideas encoded in these Vedic texts are not peculiar to a certain intellectual tradition of early Iron Age ritual specialists in the Ganges Valley, but that they are essential to the very nature and history of human thought. Consider, for example, this statement from an essay by the French economist Bruno Terray, with the uninspiring title The Socio-Cultural Dimensions of Currency, Implications for the Transition to the Euro, published in the Journal of Consumer Policy in 1999. Quote, at the origin of money, we have a relation of representation, of death as an invisible world, before and beyond life, a representation that is the product of the symbolic function proper to the human species, and which envisages birth as an original debt incurred by all men, a debt owing to the cosmic powers from which humanity emerged. Payment of this debt, which can, however, never be settled on earth, because its full reimbursement is out of reach, takes the form of sacrifices which, by replenishing the credit of the living, make it possible to prolong life, and even in certain cases to achieve eternity by joining the gods. But this initial belief claim is also associated with the emergence of sovereign powers, whose legitimacy resides in their ability to represent the entire original cosmos, and it is these powers that invented money as a means of settling debts, a means whose abstraction makes it possible to resolve the sacrificial paradox by which putting to death becomes the permanent means of protecting life. Through this institution, belief is in turn transferred to a currency stamped with an effigy of the sovereign, a money put in circulation, but whose return is organized by this other institution, which is the tax, a settlement, of the life debt. So money also takes on the function of a means of payment. Unquote. If nothing else, this provides a neat illustration of how different are standards of debate in Europe from those current in the Anglo-American world. One can't imagine an American economist of any stripe writing something like this. Still, the author is actually making a rather clever synthesis here. Human nature does not drive us to truck and barter. Rather, it ensures that we are always creating symbols, such as money itself. This is how we come to see ourselves in a cosmos surrounded by invisible forces, as in debt to the universe. The ingenious move, of course, is to fold this back into the state theory of money, since by sovereign powers, Terre actually means the state. The first kings were sacred kings who were either gods in their own right or stood as privileged mediators between human beings and the ultimate forces that governed the cosmos. This sets us on a road to the gradual realization that our debt to the gods was always, really, a debt to the society that made us what we are. The primordial debt, writes British sociologist Geoffrey Ingham, is that owed by the living to the community and durability of the society that secures their individual existence. In this sense, it's not just criminals who owe a debt to society. We are all, in a certain sense, guilty, even criminals. For instance, Ingham notes that, while there is no actual proof that money emerged in this way, there is considerable indirect etymological evidence. Quote, in all Indo-European languages, words for debt are synonymous with those for sin or guilt, illustrating the links between religion, payment, and the mediation of the sacred and profane realms by money. For example, there is a connection between money, German Geld, indemnity or sacrifice, Old English Geld, tax, Gothic Gilt, and of course, guilt. Unquote. Or, to take another curious connection, why were cattle so often used as money? The German historian Bernard Laume long ago pointed out that in Homer, when people measure the value of a ship or a suit of armor, they always measure it in oxen, even though when they actually exchange things, they never pay for anything in oxen. It is hard to escape the conclusion that this was because an ox was what one offered the gods in sacrifice. Hence, they represented absolute value. From Sumer to classical Greece, silver and gold were dedicated as offerings in temples. Everywhere, money seems to have emerged from the thing most appropriate for giving to the gods. If the king has simply taken over guardianship of that primordial debt we all owe to society for having created us, this provides a very neat explanation for why the government feels it has the right to make us pay taxes. Taxes are just a measure of our debt to the society that made us. But this doesn't really explain how this kind of absolute life debt can be converted into money, which is by definition a means of measuring and comparing the value of different things. This is just as much a problem for credit theorists as for neoclassical economists, even if the problem for them is somewhat differently framed. If you start from the barter theory of money, you have to resolve the problem of how and why You would come to select one commodity to measure just how much you want of the other ones. If you start from a credit theory, you're left with the problem I described in the first chapter, how to turn a moral obligation into a specific sum of money, how the mere sense of owing someone else a favor can eventually turn into a system of accounting in which one is able to calculate exactly how many sheep or fish or chunks of silver it would take to repay the debt. Or in this case, how do we go from that absolute debt we owe to God to the very specific debts we owe our cousins or the bartender? The answer provided by primordial debt theorists is, again, ingenious. If taxes represent our absolute debt to the society that created us, then the first step toward creating real money comes when we start calculating much more specific debts to society, systems of fines, fees and penalties, or even debts we owe to specific individuals whom we've wronged in some way, and thus to whom we stand in a relation of sin or guilt. This is actually much less implausible than it might sound. One of the puzzling things about all the theories about the origins of money that we've been looking at so far is that they almost completely ignore the evidence of anthropology. Anthropologists do have a great deal of knowledge about how economies within stateless societies actually worked, how they still work in places where states and markets have been unable to completely break up existing ways of doing things. There are innumerable studies of, say, the use of cattle as money in eastern or southern Africa, of shell money in the Americas, wampum being the most famous example, or Papua New Guinea, bead money, feather money, the use of iron rings, cowries, spondylus shells, brass rods, or woodpecker scalps. The reason that the literature tends to be ignored by economists is simple. Primitive currencies of this sort are only rarely used to buy and sell things, and even when they are, never primarily to buy and sell everyday items such as chickens or eggs or shoes or potatoes. Rather than being employed to acquire things, they are mainly used to rearrange relations between people, above all, to arrange marriages and to settle disputes, particularly those arising from murders or personal injury. There is every reason to believe that our money started in the same way. Even the English word to pay is originally derived from a word for to pacify, appease, as in to give someone something precious, for instance, to express just how badly you feel about having just killed his brother in a drunken brawl, and how much you would really like to avoid this becoming the basis for an ongoing blood feud. Debt theorists are especially concerned with this latter possibility. This is partly because they tend to skip past the anthropological literature and look at early law codes, taking inspiration here from the groundbreaking work of one of the 20th century's greatest numismatists, Philip Grierson, who in the 70s first suggested that money might first have emerged from the early legal practice. Grierson was an expert in the European Dark Ages, and he became fascinated by what have come to be known as the barbarian law codes, established by many Germanic peoples after the destruction of the Roman Empire in the 600s and 700s. Goths, Frisians, Franks, and so on, soon followed by similar codes published everywhere from Russia to Ireland. Certainly, they are fascinating documents. On the one hand, they make it abundantly clear just how wrong are the conventional accounts of Europe around this time reverting to barter. Almost all of Germanic law codes use Roman money to make assessments, penalties for theft, for instance, are almost always followed by demands that the thief not only return the stolen property, but pay any outstanding rent, or in the event of stolen money, interest, owing for the amount of time it has been in his possession. On the other hand, these were soon followed by law codes by people living in territories that had never been under Roman rule, in Ireland, Wales, Nordic countries, Russia, and these are, if anything, even more revealing. They could be remarkably creative, both in what could be used as a means of payment and on the precise breakdown of injuries and insults that required compensation. Quote, compensation in the Welsh laws is reckoned primarily in cattle, and in the Irish ones in cattle or bondmaids, with considerable use of precious metals in both. In the Germanic codes, it is mainly in precious metal. In the Russian codes, it was silver and furs, graduated from marten down to squirrel. Their detail is remarkable, not only in the personal injuries envisioned, specific compensations for the loss of an arm, a hand, a forefinger, a nail, a blow on the head so that the brain is visible or bone projects, but in the coverage some of them gave to the possessions of the individual household. Title 2 of the Salic Law deals with the theft of pigs, Title 3 with cattle, Title 4 with sheep, Title 5 with goats, Title 6 with dogs, each time with an elaborate breakdown differentiating between animals of different age and sex. Unquote. This does make a great deal of psychological sense. I have already remarked how difficult it is to imagine how a system of precise equivalences. One young, healthy milk cow is equivalent to exactly 36 chickens, could arise from the most forms of gift exchange. If Henry gives Joshua a pig and feels he has received an inadequate counter-gift, he might mock Joshua as a cheapskate. But he would have little occasion to come up with a mathematical formula for precisely how cheap he feels Joshua has been. On the other hand, if Joshua's pig just destroyed Henry's garden, and especially if that led to a fight in which Henry lost a toe, and Henry's family is now hauling Joshua up in front of the village assembly, this is precisely the context where people are most likely to become petty and legalistic and express outrage if they feel they've received one groat less than was their rightful due. This means exact mathematical specificity, for instance, the capacity to measure the exact value of a 2-year-old pregnant sow. What's more, the levying of penalties must have constantly required the calculation of equivalences. Say the fine is in marten pelts, but the culprit's clan doesn't have any martens. How many squirrel skins will do? Or pieces of silver jewellery? Such problems must have come up all the time, and led to at least a rough and ready set of rules of thumb over what sorts of valuable were equivalent to others. This would help explain why, for instance, medieval Welsh law codes can contain detailed breakdowns not only of the value of different ages and conditions of milk cow, but of the monetary value of every object likely to be found in an ordinary household, down to the cost of each piece of timber, despite the fact that there seems to be no reason to believe that most such items could even be purchased on the open market at the time. There is something very compelling in all of this. For one thing, the premise makes a great deal of intuitive sense. After all, we do owe everything we are to others. This is simply true. The language we speak and even think in, our habits and opinions, the kind of food we like to eat, the knowledge that makes our lights switch on and our toilets flush, even the style in which we carry out gestures of defiance and rebellion against social conventions. All of this we learn from other people, most of them long dead. If we were to imagine that we owe them a debt, it could only be infinite. The question is, does it really make sense to think of this as a debt? After all, a debt is by definition something that we could at least imagine paying back. It is strange enough to wish to be square with one's parents. It rather implies that one does not wish to think of them as parents anymore. Would we really want to be square with all of humanity? What would that even mean? And is this desire really a fundamental feature of human thought? Another way to put this would be, are primordial debt theorists describing a myth? Have they discovered a profound truth of the human condition that has always existed in all societies? And is it simply spelled out particularly clearly in certain ancient texts from India? Or are they inventing a myth of their own? Clearly, it must be the latter. They're inventing a myth. The choice of the Vedic material is significant. The fact is, we know almost nothing about the people who composed these texts, and little about the society that created them. We don't even know if interest-bearing loans existed in Vedic India, which obviously has a bearing on whether priests really saw sacrifice as the payment of interest on a loan we owe to death. As a result, the material can serve as a kind of empty canvas, or a canvas covered with hieroglyphics in an unknown language, on which we can project almost anything we want to. if we look through the work of ancient theologians, we find that most were familiar with the idea that sacrifice was a way by which human beings could enter into commercial relations with the gods, but that they felt it was patently ridiculous. If the gods already have everything they want, what exactly do humans have to bargain with? We've seen in the last chapter how difficult it is to give gifts to kings. With gods, let alone God, the problem is magnified infinitely. Exchange implies equality. In dealing with cosmic forces, this was simply assumed to be impossible from the start. The notion that debts to gods were appropriated by the state, and thus became the basis for taxation systems, can't really stand up either. The problem here is that in the ancient world, free citizens don't usually pay taxes. Generally speaking, tribute was levied only on conquered populations. This was already true in ancient Mesopotamia, where the inhabitants of independent cities did not usually have to pay direct taxes at all. Similarly, as Moses Finley put it, quote, "Classical Greeks looked upon direct taxes as tyrannical and avoided them wherever possible. Athenian citizens did not pay direct taxes of any sort, though the city did sometimes distribute money to its citizens. A kind of reverse taxation, sometimes directly, as with the proceeds of the Laurium silver mines, or sometimes indirectly, as through generous fees for jury duty or attending the assembly. Subject cities, however, did have to pay tribute. Even within the Persian Empire, Persians did not have to pay tribute to the great king, but the inhabitants of conquered provinces did. The same was true in Rome, where for a very long time, Roman citizens not only paid no taxes, but had a right to a share of the tribute levied on others, in the form of the dole, the bread part of the famous bread and circuses." Unquote. In other words, Benjamin Franklin was wrong when he said that in this world nothing is certain except death and taxes. This obviously makes the idea that the debt to one is just a variation on the other much harder to maintain. None of this, however, deals a mortal blow to the state theory of money. Even those states that did not demand taxes did levy fees, penalties, tariffs, and fines of one sort or another. But it is very hard to reconcile with any theory that claims states were first conceived as guardians of some sort of cosmic primordial debt. It's curious that primordial debt theorists never have much to say about Sumer or Babylonia, despite the fact that Mesopotamia is where the practice of loaning money at interest was first invented, probably 2,000 years before the Vedas were composed, and it was also the home of the world's first states. But if we look into Mesopotamian history, it becomes a little less surprising. Again, what we find there is in many ways the exact opposite of what such theorists would have predicted. The reader will recall that Mesopotamian city-states were dominated by vast temples, gigantic complex institutions, often staffed by thousands, including everyone from shepherds, barge pullers, to spinners, weavers, dancing girls, and clerical administrators. By at least 2700 BC, ambitious rulers had begun to imitate them by creating palace complexes organized on similar terms, with the exception that, where the temple centered on the sacred chambers of a god or goddess, represented by a sacred image who was fed and clothed, and entertained by priestly servants as if he or she were a living person, palaces centered on the chambers of an actual live king. Sumerian rulers rarely went so far as to declare themselves gods, but they often came very close. However, when they did interfere in the lives of their subjects in their capacity as cosmic rulers, they did not do it by imposing public debts, but rather by cancelling private ones. We don't know precisely when and how interest-bearing loans originated, since they appear to predate writing. Most likely, temple administrators invented the idea as a way of financing the caravan trade. This trade was crucial because while the river valley of ancient Mesopotamia was extraordinarily fertile and produced huge surpluses of grain and other foodstuffs, and supported enormous numbers of livestock, which in turn supported a vast wool and leather industry, It was almost completely lacking in anything else. Stone, wood, metal, even the silver used as money, all had to be imported. From quite early times then, temple administrators developed the habit of advancing goods to local merchants, some of them private, others themselves temple functionaries, who would then go off and sell it overseas. Interest was just a way for the temples to take their share of the resulting profits. However, once established, the principle seems to have quickly spread. Before long, we find not only commercial loans, but also consumer loans, usury in the classical sense of the term. By 2400 BC, it already appears to have been common practice on the part of local officials or wealthy merchants to advance loans to peasants who were in financial trouble on collateral and begin to appropriate their possessions if they were unable to pay. It usually started with grain, sheep, goats, and furniture, and then moved on to fields and houses, or alternatively and ultimately, family members. Servants, if any, went quickly, followed by children, wives, and in some extreme occasions, even the borrower himself. These would be reduced to debt peons, not quite slaves, but very close to that, forced into perpetual service in the lender's household, or sometimes in the temples or palaces themselves. In theory, of course, any of them could be redeemed whenever the borrower repaid the money, but for obvious reasons, the more a peasant's resources were stripped away from him, the harder that became. The effects were such that they often threatened to rip society apart. If for any reason there was a bad harvest, large proportions of the peasantry would fall into debt peonage. Families would be broken up. Before long, lands lay abandoned as indebted farmers fled their homes for fear of repossession and joined semi-nomadic bands on the desert fringes of urban civilization. Faced with the potential for complete social breakdown, Sumerian and later Babylonian kings periodically announced general amnesties, clean slates, as the economic historian Michael Hudson refers to them. Such decrees would typically declare all outstanding consumer debt null and void, commercial debts were not affected, return all land to its original owners, and allow all debt peons to return to their families. Before long, it became more or less a regular habit for the kings to make such a declaration on first assuming power, and many were forced to repeat it periodically over the course of their reigns. In Sumeria, these were called declarations of freedom, and it's significant that the Sumerian word amargi, the first recorded word for freedom in any known human language, literally means return to mother, since this is what the freed debt peons were finally allowed to do. Michael Hudson argues that Mesopotamian kings were only in a position to do this because of their cosmic pretensions. In taking power, they saw themselves as literally recreating human society, and so were in a position to wipe the slate clean of all previous moral obligations. Still, this is about as far from what primordial debt theorists had in mind as one could possibly imagine. Probably the biggest problem in this whole body of literature is the initial assumption that we begin with an infinite debt to something called society. It's this debt to society that we project onto the gods. It's the same debt that gets taken up by the kings and national governments. What makes the concept of society so deceptive is that we assume the world is organized into a series of compact modular units called societies, and that all people know which one they're in. Historically, this is very rarely the case. Imagine I am a Christian Armenian merchant living under the reign of Genghis Khan. What is society for me? Is it the city where I grow up? The society of international merchants, with its own elaborate codes of conduct, within which I conduct my daily affairs? Other speakers of Armenian, Christendom, or maybe just Orthodox Christendom, or the inhabitants of the Mongol Empire itself, which stretched from the Mediterranean to Korea? Historically, kingdoms and empires have rarely been the most important reference points in people's lives. Kingdoms rise and fall. They also strengthen and weaken. Governments may make their presence known in people's lives quite sporadically, and many people in history were never entirely clear whose government they were actually in. Even until quite recently, Many of the world's inhabitants were never even quite sure which country they were supposed to be in, or why it should matter. My mother, who was born a Jew in Poland, once told me a joke from her childhood. There was a small town located along the frontier between Russia and Poland. No one was ever quite sure to which it belonged. One day an official treaty was signed, and not long after surveyors arrived to draw a border. Some villagers approached them, where they'd set up their equipment on a nearby hill. "So, where are we, Russia or Poland?" "According to our calculations, your village now begins exactly 37 meters into Poland." The villagers immediately began dancing for joy. "Why?" the surveyors asked. "What difference does it make?" "Don't you know what this means?" they replied. "It means we'll never have to endure another of those terrible Russian winters." However, if we're born with an infinite debt to all those people who made our existence possible, but there is no natural unit called society, then who or what exactly do we really owe it to? Everyone? Everything? Some people or things more than others? And how do we pay a debt to something so diffuse? Or perhaps more to the point, who exactly can claim the authority to tell us how we can repay it, and on what grounds? If we frame the problem that way, the authors of the Brahmanas are offering a quite sophisticated reflection on a moral question that no one has really been able to answer any better before or since. As I say, we can't know much about the conditions under which those texts were composed, but such evidence as we do have suggests the crucial documents date from sometime between 500 and 400 BC, that is, roughly around the time of Socrates, which in India appears to have been just around the time that a commercial economy and institutions like coined money and interest-bearing loans were beginning to become features of everyday life. The intellectual classes of the time were, much as they were in Greece and China, grappling with the implications. In their case, this meant asking, what does it mean to imagine our responsibilities as debts? To whom do we owe our existence? It's significant that their answer did not make any mention either of society or states, though certainly kings and governments existed in early India. Instead, they fixed on debts to gods, to sages, to fathers, and to men. It wouldn't be at all difficult to translate their formulation into more contemporary language. We could put it this way. We owe our existence, above all, to the universe, cosmic forces, as we would put it now, to nature, the ground of our existence, to be repaid through ritual. Ritual being an act of respect and recognition to all that beside which we are small. To those who have created the knowledge and cultural accomplishments that we value most, that give our existence its form, its meaning, but also its shape. Here we would include not only the philosophers and scientists who created our intellectual tradition, but everyone from William Shakespeare to that long-since-forgotten woman somewhere in the Middle East who created leavened bread. We repay them by becoming learned ourselves and contributing to human knowledge and human culture. To our parents and their parents, our ancestors, we repay them by becoming ancestors. To humanity as a whole, we repay them by generosity to strangers, by maintaining that basic communistic ground of sociality that makes human relations, and hence life, possible. Set out this way, though, the argument begins to undermine its very premise. These are nothing like commercial debts. After all, one might repay one's parents by having children, but one is not generally thought to have repaid one's creditors if one lends the cash to someone else. Myself, I wonder, couldn't that really be the point? Perhaps what the authors of the Brahmanas were really demonstrating was that in the final analysis, our relation with the cosmos is ultimately nothing like a commercial transaction, nor could it be. That's because commercial transactions imply both equality and separation. These examples are all about overcoming separation. You're free from your debt to your ancestors when you become an ancestor. You're free from your debt to the sages when you become a sage. You're free from your debt to humanity when you act with humanity. All the more so if one is speaking of the universe. If you cannot bargain with the gods, because they already have everything, then you certainly can't bargain with the universe, because the universe is everything, and that everything necessarily includes yourself. One could in fact interpret this list as a subtle way of saying the only way of freeing oneself from the debt was not literally repaying debts, but rather showing that these debts do not exist, because one is not in fact separate to begin with, and hence the very notion of cancelling the debt and achieving a separate, autonomous existence was ridiculous from the start, or even that the very presumption of positing oneself as separate from humanity or the cosmos, so much so that one can enter into one-to-one dealings with it, is itself the crime that can be answered only by death. Our guilt is not due to the fact that we can't repay our debt to the universe. Our guilt is our presumption in thinking of ourselves as being in any sense an equivalent to everything else that exists or has ever existed, so as to be able to conceive of such a debt in the first place. Or let's look at the other side of the equation. Even if it is possible to imagine ourselves as standing in a position of absolute debt to the cosmos or to humanity, the next question becomes, who exactly has a right to speak for the cosmos or humanity to tell us how that debt must be repaid? If there's anything more preposterous than claiming to stand apart from the entire universe so as to enter into negotiations with it, it's claiming to speak for the other side. If one were looking down for the ethos for an individualistic society such as our own, one way to do it might well be to say, we all owe an infinite debt to humanity, society, nature, or the cosmos, however one prefers to frame it, but no one else could possibly tell us how we are to pay it. This at least would be intellectually consistent. If so, it would actually be possible to see almost all systems of established authority, religion, morality, politics, economics, and the criminal justice system, as so many different fraudulent ways to presume to calculate what cannot be calculated, to claim the authority to tell us how some aspect of that unlimited debt ought to be repaid. Human freedom would then be our ability to decide for ourselves how we want to do so. No one, to my knowledge, has ever taken this approach. Instead, theories of existential debt always end up becoming ways of justifying, or laying claim to, structures of morality. The case of the Hindu intellectual tradition is telling here. The debt to humanity appears only in a few early texts and is quickly forgotten. Almost all later Hindu commentators ignore it, and instead put their emphasis on a man's debt to his father. Primordial debt theorists have other fish to fry. They're not really interested in the cosmos, but actually in society. Let me return again to that word society. The reason that it seems like such a simple, self-evident concept is because we mostly use it as a synonym for nation. After all, when Americans speak of paying their debt to society, they're not thinking of paying their responsibilities to people who live in Sweden. It's only the modern state, with its elaborate border controls and social policies, that enables us to imagine society in this way, as a single bounded entity. This is why projecting that notion backwards into Vedic or medieval times would always be deceptive, even though we don't really have another word. It seems to me that this is exactly what the primordial debt theorists are doing, projecting such a notion backwards. Really, the whole complex of ideas that they're talking about, the notion that there is this thing called society, that we have a debt to it, that governments can speak for it, that it can be imagined as a sort of secular god, all of these ideas emerged together around the time of the French Revolution, or in its immediate wake. In other words, it was born alongside the idea of the modern nation-state. We can already see them coming together clearly in the work of Auguste Comte in the early 19th century France. Comte, a philosopher and political pamphleteer, now most famous for having first coined the term sociology, went so far by the end of his life as actually proposing a religion of society, which he called positivism, broadly modelled on medieval Catholicism, replete with vestments where all the buttons were on the back, so they couldn't be put on without the help of others. In his last work, which he called A Positivist Catechism, he also laid down the first explicit theory of social debt. At one point, someone asks an imaginary priest of positivism what he thinks of the notion of human rights. The priest scoffs at the very idea. This is nonsense, he says, an error born of individualism. Positivism understands only duties. After all, quote, we are born under a load of obligations of every kind to our predecessors, to our successors, and to our contemporaries. After our birth, these obligations increase or accumulate before the point where we are capable of rendering anyone any service. On what human foundation, then, could one seat the idea of rights? Unquote. While Comte doesn't use the word debt, the sense is clear enough. We've already accumulated endless debts before we get to the age at which we can even think of paying them. By that time, there's no way to calculate to whom we even owe them. The only way to redeem ourselves is to dedicate ourselves to the service of humanity as a whole. In his lifetime, Comte was considered something of a crackpot, but his ideas proved influential. His notion of unlimited obligations to society ultimately crystallized in the notion of the social debt, a notion taken up among social reformers, and eventually socialist politicians, in many parts of Europe and abroad. We are all born as debtors to society. In France, the notion of a social debt soon became something of a catchphrase, a slogan, and eventually a cliché. The state, according to this view, was merely the administrator of an existential debt that all of us have to the society that created us, embodied not least in the fact that we all continue to be completely dependent on one another for our existence, even if we're not completely aware of how. These are also the intellectual and political circles that shape the thought of Emile Durkheim, the founder of the discipline of sociology that we know today, who in a way did Comte one better by arguing that all gods in all religions are always already projections of society, so an explicit religion of society would not even be necessary. All religions, for Durkheim, are simply ways of recognizing our mutual dependence on one another, a dependence that affects us in a million ways that we're never entirely aware of. God and society are ultimately the same. The problem is that for several hundred years now, it has simply been assumed that the guardian of the debt we owe for all of this, the legitimate representatives of that amorphous social totality that has allowed us to become individuals, must necessarily be the state. Almost all socialist or socialistic regimes end up appealing to some version of this argument. To take one notorious example, this was how the Soviet Union used to justify forbidding their citizens from emigrating to other countries. The argument was always, the USSR created these people, the USSR raised and educated them, and made them who they are. What right do they have to take the product of our investment and transfer it to another country, as if they didn't owe us anything? Neither is this rhetoric restricted to socialist regimes. Nationalists appeal to exactly the same kind of arguments, especially in times of war. And all modern governments are nationalist to some degree. One might even say that what we really have in the idea of primordial debt is the ultimate nationalist myth. Once we owed our lives to the gods that created us, paid interest in the form of animal sacrifice, and ultimately paid back the principal with our lives. Now we owe it to the nation that formed us, pay interest in the form of taxes, and when it comes time to defend the nation against its enemies, to offer to pay it with our lives. This is a great trap of the 20th century. On one side is the logic of the market, where we like to imagine we all start out as individuals who don't owe each other anything. On the other is the logic of the state, where we all begin with a debt which we can never truly pay. We are constantly told that they're opposites, and that between them they contain the only real human possibilities. But it's a false dichotomy. States created markets. Markets require states. Neither could continue without the other, at least in anything like the forms we would recognize today.